It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, apocalyptic thinking. Imagine Chicago, a burnt-out husk. L.A. crumbled into the ocean. New York buried in ice. Or don't imagine it, just rent the movie. Global pandemics, alien invasions, a giant asteroid, the second coming. In Hollywood, apocalypse spells blockbuster. But we've been suckers for end-time stories for millennia. Remember Exodus? Noah's Ark? Today, we'll explore the history of apocalyptic thinking, beginning with one story that just won't die.
For over a century, I have lived in secret, hiding in the shadows, alone in the world. I am a vampire.
I've been a slave to vampires for 30 years.
What are you? What are you? You're impossibly fast and strong. Your skin is pale white and ice cold. You never eat or drink anything. You don't go out in the sunlight. I know what you are.
Say it.
Vampire.
Vampire. Vampires.
In every generation, there is a chosen one. She alone will stand against the vampires, the demons, and the forces of darkness. She is the Slayer.
Stop the spread of their evil blah, blah, blah. I've heard it, okay?
I'm not a monster.
Yes, you are a monster. Vampires are monsters. They make monster movies about them.
Well, yeah, you got me there.
Vampires. There's just no getting rid of them, is there? At least not in print. Did you know there are literally thousands of vampire novels out there today? Detective vampire novels, presidential thriller vampire novels, romances, alternate histories, nerdy, geeky teen stories, comics. They're in every possible genre. Veteran NPR correspondent Margot Adler has read a whopping 270 vampire novels, and now she's written her own book explaining why.
Well, I had read, you know, a couple of the Twilight novels on a plane. And then 8 days later, my husband, who was in perfect health, was a runner, never smoked, was, the person who was going to live to be 100 at least, you know. And he was diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer. He only lived 9 months. And I, as I was sitting by his bedside, just started having read these two Twilight novels and maybe one Anne Rice novel in the past. I just started obsessively reading them. And I think at the beginning, the journey was all about mortality.
So is this partly escape fantasy, I guess, kind of imagining what it would be like to live in a world where you and your husband, neither of you had to die?
I think it started out that way. And also what became fascinating later is I ended up reading this unbelievably interesting book called The Liquid Dreams of Vampires by Martin Ricardo. And this book analyzed the fantasies of hundreds of women and men about vampires. And what was really fascinating about it was they didn't want to have sex with them. They wanted to be them. And all of my fantasies at the time were being a vampire, not, you know, meeting a vampire or whatever. So I think that was one of the first things I learned. But then somewhere around, around 2 months into this, while I was still sort of sitting, you know, on the bedside with my husband, I suddenly went, all right, I've been meditating on mortality, and that's very interesting. But that doesn't explain the larger question, which is, you know, why did Hollywood spend $7 billion on vampire films and television shows? What is giving traction in our culture to all of this vampire literature, films, television? What's going on?
Right.
And that was what really started my journey.
So you end up with this really interesting take on that question. Vampires are us. We are the vampires?
Well, I started out, first of all, everybody said to me, you know, oh, it's all teens and sex. That's all it is, you know. And that didn't quite make sense because if you look at the classic vampire novels like Anne Rice and Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough and other people like that, there's no intercourse. There's biting, there's eroticism, but there is no intercourse.
Wait,
so
really?
I thought,
I think of those,
yes.
Somehow I think of the Anne Rice books as filled with sex.
There's sensuality, there's biting, but there's no going in and out, put it that way. There's no intercourse going on there. Absolutely none. And in fact, the vampires can't have that kind of sex in those novels. They can in a lot of other novels, but they can in those. And so I went on from there. And then one day I came across this line in a book by Nina Auerbach called Are Vampires Ourselves? And she said, every age embraces the vampire it needs. Hmm. And so one day I was just sitting around and I put all the most popular vampires in television that I could think of in the last 15 years. And I was, you know, I went the Cullens and Twilight and Stefan and Damon in The Vampire Diaries and Bill and Eric in True Blood and, oh, those, you know, Aidan and Mitchell in the Being Human. And anyway, I had a long list and I looked at them all and suddenly I went, oh my heavens, they're all conflicted. They're all desperately struggling to be moral despite being predators, often failing, but they're often, you know, that's what they are. And I suddenly went, oh, and that's exactly who we are now. Mm. We're struggling in the same way, except, and this is a simplistic way of putting it, but, you know, our blood is oil. Our blood is fossil fuels. We're sucking the lifeblood out of the planet. And
what a creepy insight, though.
That's right. And then came this really wild, wild moment. First of all, I called up Whitley Strieber, who wrote The Hunger, and I said, Whitley, am I totally crazy? I've known him for years. And he went, our prey is the planet. You know, it was really funny. But then came this other weird moment when I was saying to myself, okay, so how far back does the conflicted vampire go? It goes back probably to Barnabas and Dark Shadows. And he wasn't even really called a vampire until around 68, even though the show started before that. And that was when we saw the Earth from space. We suddenly saw ourselves as vulnerable. We saw ourselves as complicit. We saw the planet as something that the astronauts could blot out with their thumb.
We saw this vulnerable blue marble suspended in space.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I actually sort of think that our vampires changed when our view about ourselves and the Earth changed. Mm.
In all the vampire novels that you read, did you see us working out any solutions to this tension between the Earth and ourselves as predators?
Well, I just recently came across Julie Kagawa, I think is her name, and she's written a couple of sort of dystopian vampire novels. And one of them involves a young woman who's a vampire hunter. And there's this line in it that I remember, which is kind of, you know, if you become a monster, what kind of a monster will you become? Mm. And that's kind of the question, you know, will you be able to restrain yourself? Will we, as these predators on the Earth, be able to restrain ourselves and allow the planet to survive, or will we not?
And one way a lot of vampires in contemporary books try is you see them trying to abstain from drinking human blood. You
know, absolutely.
That's sort of like us trying to eat local and change our light bulbs. Recycle a whole lot. Do any vampire books have happy endings?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you'd even have to think that Twilight does in a way, doesn't it?
Because what I'm wondering about the happy endings is if you see in the vampire novels an explication of the tension between predator and prey, the Earth being the prey. For our age, I'm wondering if there are any happy resolutions.
Well, I think that I actually had an email exchange with Anne Rice that totally blew my mind. You know, I wrote her a letter and, you know, I had never met her. And I said, you know, dear Anne Rice, I'm doing this book and I'm trying to find why vampires have traction in our culture. And she wrote me an email that started out in sort of, oh, well, I have nothing more to say than anybody else. The vampire represents the outsider, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly there's this sentence. And the sentence is, but for teens, they are very attracted to vampires because they are desperately seeking a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. wow, right? And I started thinking about the Cullens having to go to high school over and over and over in those books and in the movie.
They well, if that isn't a living hell, I don't know.
Yes, exactly. That's horror, right? Suppose you had to go to your senior prom five times, right? I mean, talk about horror. So I started thinking, you know, teens have to negotiate corporate culture, jock culture, high school, parents, teacher authority figures, the whole gamut of stuff. And of course, they're looking for another way. And I also think teens have a clearer-eyed perception of the abuse of power than anybody else, because they're under the thumb of school and parents, and they see clearly, whereas all the rest of us, all of us parents, have sort of, well, we've sort of succumbed a little bit.
And they're also doing all of this while their bodies are transforming.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, Margo, where do you see vampire fiction headed next?
I think vampires are going to be sort of part of larger types of fiction. For example, if you think of the book, which I just absolutely loved, A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness. Now, there's a vampire in that book that's a very central character, but the book is not a vampire novel. In other words, I think we might see more novels in which vampires are part of the story, but they're not the whole story. I just think it'll move out in a larger way.
But Margo, you just answered the question. Vampires are having to move aside and no longer be the center of the story, just as that's what we have to do. We have to stop telling the story of the earth and the story of the world as with us at the center.
Wow. Wow. That's great. That's a great insight.
Well, it's yours.
I hadn't thought of it.
This was such fun. Thank you so much.
It was great. I really loved it.
Margo Adler is a longtime NPR news correspondent. Her new book is called Vampires Are Us. What's the best vampire novel you've ever read? We're looking for recommendations over on our Facebook page. We're talking about apocalyptic thinking in this hour. And while we're contemplating the end of the world, how about a snack?
I'm Shannon O'Malley, author of Apocalypse Cakes, Recipes for the End. Apocalypse Cakes is a cookbook of 30 cake recipes, and they're all in homage to apocalyptic eventualities. You know, after 150 years of industrial advancement, machines have become these complex, abused organisms that we've enslaved to meet our vapid capitalist ends. My iPad is definitely reading Marx and figuring out how to punish me for forcing it to process Excel spreadsheets and my dumb family vacation photos. Now, the actual robot uprising artificial food cake, it's basically frozen black jello, and it's got some mechanical parts on top. In my book, we've placed small, decorous ball bearings on the top of the jello block as a nice little garnish. But really, I mean, when you make it, you can put whatever you want on it, as long as it looks alienating and unappetizing. The 2012 Mayan chocolate cupcakes are basically just regular chocolate cupcakes with the usual pinches of cinnamon and chili powder, but you've got to make them in batches of 20 so that you can arrange them in the form of the Mayan calendar. That way, you'll be able to tell how much time you have left before the collapse of the Aquarian Age. On this date, we're not only in for the return of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent deity, who I believe will punish us for doing things like selling keychain souvenirs of him at the Cancun Radisson. But I think we're also in for things like solar storms and a collision with something called Planet X. And also the sun's galactic alignment with a supermassive black hole that will initiate a global psilocybin mushroom experience.
Shannon O'Malley's Apocalypse Cakes. And that was sound designer Joe Hartke's simulated Mayan apocalypse. There are lots more ways the world could end, and we'll talk about a bunch of them in a minute. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about apocalyptic thinking, and it's not just that people are entertained by end-time stories. A lot of us believe them. Cultural critic Barry Vacker directs the Center for Media and Destiny, and he told Steve Paulson that 27% of Americans really believed that the world would end when the Mayan calendar did in 2012.
27% of Americans thought the world was going to end like the Mayan prophecy?
Yes, 27% thought it was likely to happen. The number in China was 20%. In another survey, the percentages of people believing in apocalyptic scenarios is extremely high. 37% of Americans believe that the day after tomorrow could happen, and that's the Roland Emmerich film about instant climate change and instant ice age. 31% believe that Armageddon could happen. That's the one with the meteor hitting us. So there are a lot of beliefs out there, various apocalyptic scenarios. The Mayan one was easy to discredit, but I think that kind of worked as a cover story because, let's face it, the war on terror is apocalyptic. Iraq is apocalyptic. I think you could say that war itself is apocalyptic.
So this obsession with the coming end of the world, I mean, it helps to explain a lot of the books and movies and TV shows that
yes.
trade on this idea. And, you know, dystopianism obviously fits into this as well.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and the sort of the sci-fi fantasy stuff, zombies, vampires, it's all sort of part of the same thing. But then I guess it raises the question, well, are all those movies and books and TV shows creating this apocalyptic fervor or are they reflecting it?
I think it's probably both because growing up in the Cold War, which ended in 1990 and 91, there was the fear of the nuclear apocalypse. That is not on the radar near as much. But we now have the ecological apocalypse, whether that's measured as climate change, rising ocean levels, global warming, ecological destruction. There's also the idea of a resource apocalypse, that we're going to exhaust the Earth's resources. And there's also the idea of the digital apocalypse, that we will create these machines that will be so powerful and so small that they will go in and alter human consciousness and create a new human. So the real human will be gone and be replaced by some kind of digitalized human. That's sort of the Ray Kurzweil scenario.
Right.
And you mentioned the zombie apocalypse. And I would say there's two others. The cosmic apocalypse, the idea that Earth could get obliterated by the cosmos, be it a meteor, asteroid, black hole, supernova. The scenarios always have embedded, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, an end and a beginning.
Well, and my guess is that this apocalyptic meme operates at some emotional level as well. And you have this fascinating discussion in your book about how experiencing this sense of the apocalypse allows us to get to the sublime, almost sort of a religious experience. Can you explain this?
Well, I would say that the sublime doesn't have to be a religious experience at all. I would say the sublime is the sense of awe and wonder, often tinged with terror. And it's that feeling when we gaze upon the stars in a night sky, on a clear night sky, you know, away from the cities where we can actually see the stars. We see the radiant ribbon of the Milky Way going across the sky. So we're in awe and wonder. Or maybe we're standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon and we look down in it and we experience this awe and wonder. So the sublime is what happens when we confront several different things, one of which would be the vast forces of nature, the forces that made the Grand Canyon, the forces of the cosmos, maybe, you know, the forces of a tidal wave. We can also have a sense of the technological sublime. In other words, we can marvel at the powers of the internet and just to sort of contemplate the fact that there's 1.5 billion people hooked up to the internet. No, I think it's more than that. I think it's up to 2 billion now, whatever the total is. But we have billions of people hooked up to the internet, and it's been running for over 25 years without ever turning off. And we can sort of contemplate this vast network that we're building. It's awe-inspiring, but yet its surveillance powers are terrifying. Its ability to trivialize knowledge down to, you know, the 30-second soundbite on YouTube is also kind of terrifying. So the sublime can give us this sense of something awesome, powerful, amazing, and even wondrous is happening. But if it's life-threatening or challenges our worldview or challenges our sense of how big we are in the universe, some people might find it terrifying too.
Well, I want to go back to this idea of the cosmic sublime, sort of the, you know, tapping into the larger universe. And you make the point that to some degree, it goes back to that very famous Apollo 8 photo from 1968, you know, the first photo that that showed the Earth from these astronauts who were circling the moon, and arguably the most influential photograph in history.
Well, I think it had an impact because it was the first time we were able to get off the planet and look back at the planet. And as several of the astronauts had referred to, we went to the moon, but we discovered Earth. But what most people don't know is that the, you know, let's make sure everybody knows what image we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's called Earthrise. It's the one with Earth rising above the moon's surface. It was captured, I believe, on December 24th by the Apollo 8 astronauts. And so what we see is this image of Earth coming up above the blank horizon or the desolate horizon of the moon, and the Earth is floating against a black sky. But that image has been flipped. The original image, Earth was not coming up over the horizon. It was coming around the horizon. The original image, there's nothing under Earth.
So the moon is on the one side, on the right side, and the Earth is on the left side.
Floating on its own. And why NASA changed that, I think it's pretty clear. The image is much more comforting. When Earth is rising above the moon, there's still something under it. It's more like a sunrise as opposed to Earth, you know, what we would call this image, Earth void, Earth floating in the void there.
Well, let's skip ahead then in our technology to our own time with all of the new technologies, social media, Facebook. Is there any connection between this and, I don't know, that sense of the global of the cosmic from 40 years ago?
Well, that's a great question. And one of the things we have to understand is that media technologies, and I mean the telescopes we have, the computers, the internet and things, that are able to peer out beyond our night skies into the vast universe, we now know that there's far more than the Milky Way. So on any given night, you walk out away from your city in the remote vastness of the desert, you'll see 3,000 to 4,000 stars, something like that with your naked eye. But the Milky Way has at least 1 to 200 billion stars. There are at least 100 to 200 billion galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars. And those galaxies are basically all moving away from each other in vast webs and networks, pushed apart by these vast voids of what apparently is some kind of dark energy. And the universe is enormously vast and enormously old, and we're not at the center of space or the center of time. Science has given us the infinite.
Well, so and then I suppose one other parallel then is just as we are not the center of the universe, you know, in Facebook, there is no center. I mean, there are a multiplicity of, you know, different little nodes.
Yes, exactly. Except each user, it seems if you're the center. And I would say that social media are how we counter the effects of cosmic media. Let's say the Hubble telescope looking out is cosmic media. And so in a sense, when you go into Facebook or to Twitter, it's as if you're the center of the vast network. And in a way, it's a network starring you, about you, integrated around you. And so you're seeing this sort of in this mediated universe that we inhabit where the internet is running 24/7 and it's wireless, it's all around us. There's a way to anchor yourself with social media that I think is a existential consolation for the fact that we're not the center of anything. We can pretend like we are. We're the center of nothing, so we can pretend like we're the center of everything.
So getting back to our discussion of the apocalypse then, I mean, we're bringing in then, you know, the impact of new technologies. And you write about what you call the virtual apocalypse. What is that?
Facebook.
what makes that apocalyptic, though?
Well, I'm borrowing the term. I did not invent the term virtual apocalypse. I'm borrowing the term from the French theorist who sort of extended Marshall McLuhan's ideas, and that would be Jean Baudrillard. And he wrote of a culture in which media had so permeated our world, so permeated our surrounding diaspora of our homes, our houses, our businesses, that what we have is a world in which everything we know to be true and real is filtered through media. It comes through media, such that media, in effect, are destroying reality. The reality in the sense of the original reality or an authentic reality or an untouched reality. He would probably say Facebook is the same thing, because the amount of time spent in Facebook, you're actually creating a world in which your mediated life is more important and more valuable and more seductive than actually a real life.
Well, that's a very cynical view of this. I mean, some people would say, you know, they're having very real interactions with other people they might not be able to, you know, have face-to-face encounters with.
I would say they're having simulated encounters. I don't think you can get the depth of experience. And this is not a Luddite position. I'm not against Facebook. I'm just trying to explain it here. That I think that it's a simulation of it. I think you can simulate friendship and simulate agreement by you can do a thumbs up, you like it, right, without having to really think about it or analyze it. Or you can do a quick thumbs down without really having to critically engage it. It's a simulated experience of friendship, a simulated experience of connecting. I don't think it's the real deal.
I can't help wondering if we would be better off without these apocalyptic memes, which raises the question, is there a better meme out there to think about our future?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there are for the memes to survive, they have to offer some kind of benefit. And there are a couple of others that I didn't get to, these benefits, one of which is the clean slate. Sweep aside the mistakes, sweep aside the debris, and start over. And I think everybody in their personal lives has at one time said, man, if I could just start over, I might do something different. Or if I could just get past this big problem, I'll sweep it aside and I'll begin anew. And I think what's true for the individual is also true for society in many ways. And so I would say sort of at the end of the day, though, there's still this question of our significance in this grand narrative of the universe as revealed by our technologies. And that's what I call the sort of the cosmic apocalypse, the idea that we could be obliterated by the vast universe, but more importantly, what if we're not? What if we just keep going on, and what does it mean to be in this vast universe of which we're seemingly insignificant? And that triggers what I call the philosophical apocalypse. For the fact is our social and cultural and philosophical narratives have not caught up with what our science has revealed. What does it mean to exist on a tiny planet in a vast universe? Are we insignificant, or have we evolved? Are we one form of cosmic evolution that allows the universe to know itself? Maybe that's our justification to continue to exist, is that we are one small way that the universe has become aware of itself and has created a lot of art and a lot of science and technology to try to know that universe and make meaning of it. That might be the best reason to justify our existence. Surely it's not because of all the tribal wars and imaginary great destinies.
Barry Vacker directs the Center for Media and Destiny, and he teaches at Temple University. Steve Paulson talked with him about his book, The End of the World Again. As long as we're talking about apocalyptic scenarios, let's go back to one of the first, the Bible's Book of Revelation, with its epic showdown between God and Satan.
I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled.
Revelation is the last book in the Bible, and historian Elaine Pagel says it's also the most controversial. She's a renowned scholar. You might remember her award-winning book, The Gnostic Gospels. Well, she's also the author of Revelations, Vision, Prophecy, and Politics. Steve Paulson talked with her.
How influential is the Book of Revelation today?
The Book of Revelation, weird as it is probably one of the most popular books in the New Testament. I mean, apart from the Gospels, there's nothing that's more widely read among some people. Some Christians love it and read it all the time, and some would never touch it.
Why? Why does this book resonate with so many people?
Well, that's a really good question, and I guess that started me out because, you know, the book is very strange. I think it's because it consists of dreams and nightmares, visions. There's really no teaching in it. I mean, it's almost, you know, the way children dream or the way any of us dream.
Well, there's this whole apocalyptic nature to it, right? I mean, Christ as the terrifying warrior, Satan as a red dragon. I mean, it's the imagery is pretty stark.
The imagery is exactly why I think it is so powerful. I mean, it just has a universal appeal.
Is this just a very different kind of book than you find in the rest of the New Testament?
It's very different. You know, it didn't have any teaching of Jesus. In fact, it probably wasn't a Christian book in the beginning. It was written by John, who saw himself as a Jewish prophet in the tradition of the prophets. He wouldn't have called himself a Christian because he thought that meant those Gentiles who follow Paul, and he wasn't one of them. He didn't like them either. but he saw himself in the tradition of the great prophets, and Jesus as the chosen king of Israel, who was, although crucified and killed, was going to come back and rule the entire world. It's a vision that he elaborated from what he found in the prophets like Daniel, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah.
So were there particular historical circumstances that John was reacting against as he was framing this prophecy?
Well, the whole book, I think, is wartime literature. It's the experiences of somebody who was probably a refugee from the Jewish war against Rome, in which Jews rebelled against Roman control in 66 and started a revolution. They were completely wiped out by the Romans, and the city of Jerusalem completely destroyed, the center of Jerusalem charred to rubble by the year 70. And I think it was that horrifying, terrifying experience. But John thought that Jesus had prophesied it 30 years before, saying, well, Jesus said it would happen. Look, it's happened. Now he's about to come back.
So how does this play out then in the book of Revelation, this story of the rebellion against Rome and then being crushed by Rome?
You know, it's not told that way at all. It's all in a kind of wild apocalyptic code about the forces of evil as enormous dragons, the forces of good as Jesus on a white horse coming with the armies of heaven. So what you have is a sort of conflict between the forces of good and evil in the sort of wild supernatural. And it climaxes in a huge battle, the Battle of Armageddon, and the forces of good win and the forces of evil are destroyed. And you realize that this is basically the structure of much of our drama. A movie like Star Wars or a movie like Lord of the Rings is all about forces of good against the forces of evil, and it's a terrible fight, and evil almost makes it but loses in the end, and so forth. And so this kind of story is fundamental to the way we think about drama.
Because the book of Revelation is so different from the other books in the New Testament, how did it get into the New Testament? I mean, we know that there were lots of things that were written back then. Some made it into the canon, became part of sort of the established Christian tradition. Lots of other things didn't make it in. Why did this book?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, I think this kind of story about clash between good and evil is a way to make sense out of conflict, any conflict. It could be a conflict with your boss. It could be conflict with Al-Qaeda. It has a very deep appeal to people as a sort of sense that there is meaning in terrible conflict and even in terrible suffering and a kind of assurance that the good will win. But there are many other books of Revelation that didn't make it in, and they have a much more universal vision. So I've been thinking about the question you ask. I think I've come up with a guess.
Okay.
The person who put it in is somebody who was one of the architects of Orthodox Christianity. And he wanted to insist that you have to sign this creed, which he helped draft. His name is Athanasius. He was the Archbishop of Egypt. And you have to join the Orthodox Church and give up all your crazy ideas. And that way you'll be saved. Otherwise, you're going into certain hell and destruction. And this book is the perfect way to cap the collection. So he reinterpreted the whole thing and sort of updated it, as people always do, and it worked very well for his purpose.
It sounds like there was this attempt to separate out the Orthodox Christians, the good Christians, from the heretics. Were the heretics the bad Christians, or were they the pagans?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, they were the Christians that didn't believe things the way Athanasius did. So he wanted to insist that there was only one kind of Christianity and not different points of view. And he was working under the patronage of a Christian emperor who had military force to support it. And that emperor, well, from Constantine on, the emperors who were Christian wanted to unify the empire under one kind of Christianity. So that meant you can't have a lot of kinds. So his purpose was to destroy the heretics, as they were called.
And what were some of the messages of the heretics? I mean, what were the versions of Christianity that did not make it?
Well, significantly, the versions of the Christianity that didn't make it said you didn't need the church, and you didn't need the priest, you didn't need the bishops. You could find God by some kind of solitary search on your own, but they were much more independent kind of spiritual path that didn't require the institutional church that Athanasius was trying to establish.
Now, do you think the Book of Revelation was intended to be read literally?
Well, it was intended to be read as sort of God's victory will triumph over the forces of evil. You can't really read it literally. I don't think so. But you don't have to read it literally to take it seriously. That is, to take it as a serious message of hope. I mean, it's been read for 2,000 years. It was read during the wars between Catholics and Protestants. It was read on both sides. It was read on both sides of the Civil War. It was read on both sides of World War II. It's read on both sides of the current wars that are going on in the world. Because its imagery is so wild and so imaginative, you can kind of plug it into any conflict you happen to have.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. My sense is that today in America, the Book of Revelation is taken particularly seriously by conservative Christians, and it's almost something of an embarrassment among a lot of liberal Christians.
Well, that's true, because a lot of less conservative Christians feel that it's kind of been co-opted, as it has. I mean, since the beginning of the 20th century, there were evangelical Christians who read the book and actually mapped out very specifically, you know, this means this and this means this, this means the Soviet Union and this means the United States and this means China and so forth. And they've revised it as the enemies shift and change. But it is being read, you know, in terms of the world map, in terms of world conflict.
How do you take it? You are a Christian yourself.
I've started out rather disliking it, but now that I've been working on it, I realize how powerful it is and how it works on people. I mean, artists have been drawn to it, poets like John Milton, artists like Blake, Bosch, Michelangelo, and contemporary artists. There's a huge amount of film and video games, all kinds of ways that this very powerful kind of imagery plays out. So I have a very mixed, ambivalent response to this book.
Now, I'm curious about why you became so interested in the Book of Revelation, because it would seem to be a departure from your earlier work on studying the history of the New Testament. I mean, you're best known for your work on the Gospels and the Gnostic Gospels, and this would seem to be very different.
Well, yes, except that you see, with the secret Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas, there were also found many, many texts called texts of revelation. And what I realize is that those revelations are very different. They're often about the divine that is present potentially in everyone, rather like a Buddhist teaching, you know, that a person could seek for enlightenment or that the divine is available in the world. Jewish mysticism says the same thing. And what I'm looking at, again, is how there are different ways to think about revelation than this way, this sort of end-of-the-world catastrophe.
That's Elaine Pagels talking with Steve Paulson about her book Revelations. She's a historian at Princeton. And her book on the Gnostic Gospels is one of Modern Library's 100 best books of the 20th century. When we come back, we'll sample one of the many new histories coming out this year to mark the 100th anniversary of the beginning of World War I. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, my name is Richard Powers. I'm the author of 11 novels, most recently, Orfeo. I went back through my reader's notebooks of 40 years in which I've recorded everything that I've read over the last four decades, and I looked for a book that has the largest gap between the number of readers who actually read it and the number of readers who I'm sure could take intense pleasure and delight. And that book is Arthur Saltzman's Objects and Empathy. This book is a collection of lyrical essays on a variety of intimate subjects written by a man of great wit and soul and intelligence who died way too young. Saltzman was a scholar of contemporary American literature. He wrote about many, many fiction writers. But I think he will be remembered as the author of several collections of personal essays that spin glorious, word-drunk fantasias out of everything from board games, boys in a back alley in suburban Chicago, his father's gambling, the way that Michael Jordan moves on a basketball court. This is a man who's constantly at play in the fields of language. He's keen, he's honest, he's super smart, but he's also just joyously and sometimes devilishly funny. His lyrical essays span the whole spectrum of human emotion, but I think I love him mostly because he's a man who knows that there's no passion greater than our desire for connecting through words. Saltzman is the master of the resonant epigram in Objects and Empathy. He talks about creation in this way. He says, there's a joke going around Sunday school. In the beginning, there was nothing. Then God said, let there be light. There was still nothing, but now you could see it. And about men and their endless competition, he says, most alpha males mollify down the alphabet a bit. About fate, he says, fate is a flirt. As she bats her lashes at the end of the bar, we wonder if she's beckoning us or suffering from allergies. And about life as we live it, he has this finally to say. So we reside for a time between astronomy and mulch. In fact, the sky is full of light, full of bright fatalities, like an eternal series of deferred payments. And all of it is my portion tonight, as far as I can see.
Richard Powers is the author of 11 novels. His latest is Orfeo. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. With conflict in the Ukraine and Crimea, we've been thinking about how this year marks the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I. Oxford University historian Margaret Macmillan has studied the history of World War I. A while ago, Jim Fleming talked with her about a book called The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914.
It is almost a century now since the First World War began, and we tend to view it as the beginning of an almost endless war. You've kind of flipped that around and looked at it as the end of the peace. Was it really that?
Well, Europe had enjoyed an extraordinarily long period of peace since 1815, so a century of peace, and it had been a century marked by extraordinary progress, increasing prosperity, people were living longer, life was getting better in many ways. It wasn't that the whole world was peaceful. There were colonial wars, there were wars around the world, but they were nothing like what was going to come.
The Russians fought the Japanese, the French fought the Germans, the British fought in South Africa. None of that gave them any experience or enough experience to understand that the next war could last.
Well, it should have given them warning, but I think all those wars ended with a decisive victory for one side or the other, and then a peace was made and things went on. And so I think European military planners and strategic planners had got used to the idea that you fought a war, there were a few battles, somebody won, somebody lost, and then you made peace. I think they should have known better because there was plenty of evidence from the American Civil War onwards that it was getting more and more difficult to attack, that attackers were sustaining terrific losses, and that stalemate was a very real possibility.
I want to go back to this question that is in the title of your book. Is it more important to figure out what started the war, or is it essential that we understand how the peace ended?
Well, I wanted to look at the piece because it seems to me there's so many possible reasons for the First World War. Of course, it's one of the reasons we keep worrying about it and puzzling over it, that there's a danger of assuming it was inevitable, that it was bound to happen because there were tensions and then the tensions exploded and that was that. And it seems to me that what is equally interesting is how that long peace was maintained and why the mechanisms and the ways they had of maintaining it finally broke down in 1914. And there was real sentiment in favor of peace. I mean, Europe wasn't filled with warmongers, and there were a great many people who thought that war was something Europeans no longer did. There were other ways of settling disputes. And so it seemed to me that an interesting way of looking at the outbreak of the First World War is to see what went wrong, what failed in that long century, what failed at the end, and why did war break out?
One of the things that I think modern public don't understand is that Germany was a very young country at this point.
Well, I sometimes say to my fellow Canadians, Germany is younger than Canada, which is true. I mean, Germany only came into existence in 1871, and it was, like a lot of young and rising powers, I think, uncertain and not always very tactful in the way it went about things. I think there was a feeling in Germany that its very real economic and military power ought to be recompensed by a bigger empire, by a bigger place in the world, a bigger say in world affairs. And I think the Germans, like often rising powers, were brash and often disturbed the order.
You can look at that and see the terror rising, if you will. Why was it not obvious to everyone who looked at it then?
I think people got used to it. The peace had lasted a long time. There had been a series of crises, and if you look at those crises, they're getting closer and closer together. But every time Europe had muddled through, there'd been meetings of international statesmen, conferences of ambassadors, deals had been done. And so I think by 1914, there was almost a dangerous complacency. Here's another one in the Balkans. We're used to this. Someone somewhere is going to deal with it, and we'll all be able to get on with our lives.
And there was, as you say, this sense of the world as a place where war couldn't happen anymore. Part of that was the rise of science and rationality. What happened to diminish the impact of this rising intelligence we all thought was going to rule our lives?
Well, I think you got strains within European society. I mean, people believed in science, they believed in reason, but it wasn't answering. Those weren't answering all questions. I mean, rather like our own times. I mean, we have a great faith in science, but we realize there are questions that science really cannot answer about how to have a just society, how to distribute wealth. And the rise of things like nationalism and socialism and revolutionary ideologies really shook people and made them think that Europe perhaps was not quite the calm and stable and rational place they had thought it was.
One of the things that's fascinating about this, I think, is to realize how much the world then resembles the world we live in now. It's that sense of the world becoming a smaller place. The war, though it was European, was really a worldwide war. It wasn't just France and Germany and England, was it?
No, it wasn't at all. It involved their empires. And, of course, in those days, the Europeans dominated much of the world. And so you had African soldiers fighting in Europe. You had soldiers from India. You had soldiers from Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Newfoundland, soldiers from Vietnam. And you also had fighting in parts of Africa, parts of Asia, and parts of the Pacific. So it was a world war. And I think it's one of those paradoxes that globalization, which was certainly true of the world before 1914 and is true of our world, doesn't necessarily make people get on better. In fact, what you saw in Europe before 1914, and I think we're seeing it now, tremendous growth of nationalism. And I think in some ways, it's almost a reaction against globalization.
Because we are all trying to live in the same world, it becomes more important to establish your individual world?
I think so. I think identity became very, very important. And I think we're seeing the same thing now in the revival of religious ideology, for example, where people are identifying themselves very firmly with a particular religion or a particular sect. And I think we're also seeing, again, the rise of nationalist ideologies. In Europe, there's considerable worry now about immigrants and what are they doing to French society or British society or Dutch society. So I think it's a sort of paradox with globalization that it sometimes produces these intensely localized and particular reactions. And in fact, when the war came, it became quite apparent that nationalist feeling was growing up from the grassroots as much as it was coming down from above.
Was there any hope, do you think, that the pre-war Europe could have been sustained?
Well, I think there's always hope. I mean, it had been sustained through crisis after crisis. I think it has. I mean, if you look at the Europe of since 1945, it has been a relatively, in fact, largely peaceable Europe. I think war could have been avoided in 1914. What was so dangerous was that by 1914, so many people, particularly those in positions of authority, had got used to the idea that a war was coming. And if you think that a war is bound to come, then you start thinking about when you can wage it best, and you stop thinking about how you can avoid it.
It's funny, isn't it, to talk about allowing expectations to be met and planning for things that you don't want to happen. Presumably, there were some who wanted war.
Well, there were some who wanted war and at different levels. I mean, there were some who felt that European society was getting degenerate. The very success and the very prosperity of European society worried some. And there was a fear that the race was getting soft, the human race, or that the individual nations within the human race were getting soft. And so there were those who said war is good for the nation. It perks you up. It's like a tonic. It brings out the best in people. This often, of course, was said by people who weren't themselves going to have to go off and fight. So there was that. But you also had, in the military planning, those who said, well, look, if we're going to have to fight, this is the best time to do it. And in the German high command, you got a real fear by 1914 of what Russia was doing. And so the nightmare for the German high command was of a big, modern, industrialized Russia with its much bigger pool of manpower whistling up huge armies and sending them over the borders into Germany. And the Russians were building railways very, very fast. They were industrializing very fast. Their growth rates were huge. And the German high command said in 1914, by 1917, we're not going to be able to fight Russia. We can take them now, we can hold them now, we can defeat them now. We won't be able to do that in 1917. So you had very much the same calculation that the Japanese high command were making in 1941 before Pearl Harbor, that if we're going to have to fight the United States, we better do it now because later on we won't have a chance.
Do you feel, having looked at all of this, that that lesson has been learned? Or is there in this a lesson that we have yet to learn about the world we live in today?
Well, if there are lessons from the period before 1914, I do think it is that the civilians have to know what it is the military are up to. And the German civilians really allowed the German military to make their plans and didn't bother to inform themselves. They felt it wasn't their business. And I do think there's got to be strong civilian control of the military. You have to know what they're planning. You have to know what they're doing. I think also we all have to collectively manage the shifts in international power. So when you get rising nations who are as yet unsure of their place in the world, China today, for example, or possibly Brazil or possibly India, it's incumbent on the more established nations to try and bring them in and try and work with them. And I think that's very important. Managing these periods of transition is very, very important.
Well, let's hope then that there will never be a book about the war that ended the peace, the road to 2014?
Oh, let us hope not. We can't possibly afford it anymore. The weapons are too dreadful.
That's historian Margaret McMillan. Her book is called The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.